You're with us for the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Electronics giant Foxconn was expected to build these so-called innovation centers in five cities in Wisconsin. They were slated to create hundreds of jobs. We're asking why these centers have stalled. What questions do you have about Foxconn's research and development in Wisconsin? What do you think about its job creation thus far and these innovation centers on hold? We're at 800-642-1234 to join in. Corinne Hess is WPR's reporter in Milwaukee. Corey, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thank you for having me.
Remind us what Foxconn wanted to do with these innovation centers. What's the goal here?
Well, Foxconn announced these innovation centers not too long after their massive manufacturing plant in Mount Pleasant was first announced. And the goal was to create between 100 and 200 high-skilled jobs throughout the state. In fact, former Governor Scott Walker was calling them sort of the Foxconn bonus.
What would happen inside these innovation centers?
Well, you know, it was never perfectly clear, but the goal was, again, to create, you know, high-skilled, high-tech jobs. They were going to be sort of research and development type jobs. And they were going to be, the first one was announced in Milwaukee, and that innovation center was also going to be Foxconn's North American headquarters. That was going to have 500 jobs. And then the others were announced sort of over time in Green Bay, Eau Claire, Racine, and most recently Madison. And those were each going to have between 100 and 200 jobs.
Were these innovation centers so supposed to be a bridge to the colleges, a bridge to the UW?
Well, that's actually a more recent development. Just this month, Foxconn announced a new initiative called Earn and Learn, where they're going to be working with some local schools. And that's a program where college students can work at Foxconn full time, and they'll be doing that at these innovation centers, although the innovation centers aren't yet built. So how that's all going to work, I'm not sure.
So,
So
the innovation centers was also, you know, this way to recruit students. And then there was Gateway Technical College in Racine and Chippewa Valley Technical College in Eau Claire. Is that still happening?
Well, like you said, this Earn and Learn, this is a new initiative. I think the original intent of the innovation centers was just to put, you know, adults to work for Foxconn across the state.
We're talking with Corey Hess. She is WPR's reporter based in Milwaukee. She's been reporting on Foxconn's innovation centers that have not come to fruition yet. Are you a student at Gateway Technical College in Racine or Chippewa Valley Technical College in Eau Claire, perhaps UW Parkside? Do you want to take advantage of Foxconn's recruitment program? Join in the conversation at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Corey, you talked with Aaron White, Eau Claire's economic development manager, about Foxconn's planned innovation center in Eau Claire. Here's a takeaway from your time with them.
They didn't give much of an indication on a timeline, but they still kind of reinforced their intent to move forward with the project eventually in Eau Claire. So we're still kind of working under the impression that it will occur at some point in time.
So Aaron is expressing hope, a bit of optimism there that these centers will come to pass. Have you heard similar things from other people?
I have. I also spoke to Kevin Vonk, who's in Green Bay. He's their development director. And he said the same thing. He had a visit from about, I think, four people from Foxconn in the summer. And he said that even though his innovation center is paused right now, he's hoping that they start work next year. The way he put it was Foxconn's a multi-billion-dollar corporation with properties all over the world. So, you know, he said sometimes people think that Green Bay is the center of the world because of the Green Bay Packers, but yeah, they're probably a little bit smaller than Foxconn. I also spoke to the people in Racine who said that, again, Foxconn has put this building on hold, the Innovation Center, because they're focused on what's going on with the Mount Pleasant campus.
But you did see there that they pulled a building permit for the Innovation Center in Racine last week. How should we interpret that?
You know, I'm not sure. So the building permit was pulled right after our story ran, and it's for 1,400 square feet, which isn't very big. And we'll see what happens. I don't know, you know, what they're going to do, if that means they're going to move forward. When I talked to Racine officials just the day before, they had said that Innovation Center was on hold. So, you know, just a few months ago, they had done $2 million worth of work on the Innovation Center in Eau Claire, and that center is still on hold. So, I mean, Foxconn has purchased all the buildings in these different cities, so they own them. And I do think that some work is being done. I just don't know if they're doing as much work as they are in Mount Pleasant.
Oh, so these buildings are purchased. This isn't leased space at all.
No, they've purchased the buildings. Just in the last few months, they've purchased a building in Madison for over $9 million. So they own the buildings.
How are these agreements working? How are the Innovation Centers going to be funded once they do get up and running?
The local municipalities are not paying for this. This is Foxconn funded. So I also think that that's why maybe they're moving a little slower than what people would like to see, because as Aaron White said in Appleton, you know, they haven't really been following it as closely as they maybe would other projects, because they have no money involved. So this is just, it's on Foxconn's time and on their dime, you know, they just are moving at their own speed.
And so if these jobs at these innovation centers do come to fruition, would they be qualified for the state tax credits?
They would, yes. I reached out to the Wisconsin Economic Development Corporation, which has been monitoring this, and they would fall under the same purview as the other jobs, the jobs being created in Mount Pleasant. So at the end of every year, WEDIC gets a jobs report and finds out if Foxconn met their goal for the year, and then they get the state tax credits. So this, you know, last year they did not meet their goal. And we'll find out at the end of the year if they meet their goal for this year.
I was going to say, we're getting close to the end of December, so we should be finding out this year pretty soon how Foxconn is doing on hiring.
We should.
What does it look like for the future of the factory itself in Mount Pleasant? What have you seen there in terms of preparation on that land?
Well, a few months ago, they started building their 1 million square foot manufacturing plant, and they just got approval for another building where they're going to be doing more research and more kind of this high-tech work. And they're not exactly saying too much about what type of work they're going to be doing there. They're moving forward with some buildings out there.
Corey, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Corinne Hess is WPR's reporter in Milwaukee. She's been reporting on Foxconn innovation centers that are on hold around the state. Coming up on Capitol Hill, Wisconsin lawmakers on both sides of the aisle are united behind cheese, natural cheese, that is. A new bipartisan bill would create a formal definition of natural cheese. Do you pay attention to how your cheese is made before you buy it? Would you support clearer definitions for categories of cheeses? Join in at 800-642-1234. We'll be back in a moment to discuss the CURD Act. What an acronym there. Stay with us here on the Ideas Network. If you're just joining us, we're learning about the CURD Act on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. CURD stands for Codifying Useful Regulatory Definitions, C-U-R-D, and the goal is to protect the integrity of natural cheese without any confusion from the likes of processed cheese. rethink the Velveeta and Cheez-Whiz of the world. So this is federal legislation with bipartisan support. Are you a Wisconsin cheesemaker? How did you get into the industry? What types of cheese do you make? Do you support legally defining natural cheese? We're at 800-642-1234. Scientist Mark Johnson is assistant director at the Center for Dairy Research at UW-Madison. His research includes developing, manufacturing, and ripening protocols for unique cheeses, a study of cheese characteristics, and cheese defects. Mark, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Well, thank you for having me, Kate.
So the CURD Act, it would legally define what counts as natural cheese. What do you make of this legislation?
We don't have a definition of natural cheese. The FDA has a definition for processed cheese, but not natural cheese. There needs to be a definition for what natural is because other organizations are looking to define what natural is, and it doesn't necessarily include how we make cheese, natural cheese.
So you would support it?
Oh, absolutely.
Like, yeah.
Absolutely.
How does the CURD Act define natural cheese? What are the parameters here?
Well, it's states that we use milk, we can add a coloring agent, we use bacteria, we can add rennet and salt.
What is rennet?
Rennet is a clotting agent. We get milk to solidify.
How is it different from processed cheese?
Okay, natural cheese is made by adding starter bacteria to milk. The starter bacteria ferment lactose and create lactic acid. Cheese making is really a dehydration and fermentation process. So after we add the bacteria, they're always fermenting the sugar, natural sugar. We add a clotting agent, rennet, that solidifies the milk. We can then cut the curd or the solidified milk into curds that are about half an inch to a quarter an inch in diameter, and this helps facilitate the loss of whey. So milk is about 87% water. Cheese is going to be 37% water. So by cutting into small cubes, I remove some of the water. Along with heating the curds, I also expel some of the whey. And once we get the right amount of acid developed, the right amount of water loss from the curd, we then drain to separate the whey from the curd. And when that's all drained off, we add salt. We let it mellow for about a half an hour, and then we put it into a box, and we press it. And that helps to squeeze the individual curd particles into a solid mass of cheese. The blocks could be 5 pounds, 20 pounds, 40 pounds, 700 pounds. And then about 3 weeks later, we put the cheese then, after it's in the box and press it, we put it into a ripening room where it develops flavor. So the ripening room could be 3 weeks up to several years, where during that time it develops flavor. That's a natural cheese. Have you ever had a pizza and you see oil on the surface?
Yes.
Okay, you use natural cheddar and you put it on a hamburger and it oils off?
Mm-hmm.
In order to prevent that from happening, we make a processed cheese. Processed cheese also doesn't ripen. So we take natural cheese, we add emulsifying salts that change the structure of the protein so they surround the fat and prevent the fat from leaking out when you heat it. That's the big difference. These emulsifying salts are sodium phosphate and sodium citrate. We heat this blend to around 165 degrees. It kills bacteria and enzymes that might be present in the cheese, so it's basically a shelf-stable product. It doesn't age, it doesn't ripen, get more flavor. One of the misconceptions about processed cheese is how much cheese is in processed cheese?
Yeah.
Greater than 95%.
Oh, wow.
The rest of it is maybe no more than about 2.5 to 3% of the emulsifying salts. The rest is butter and added water. So it's natural cheese that we've converted into a shelf-stable product that doesn't oil off.
We're talking about the CURD Act and the distinction between natural cheese and processed cheese with Mark Johnson. He's a cheese technologist for the Center for Dairy Research at UW-Madison. You can join in. Are you a dairy farmer? Where do you sell your milk? Do you work in a cheese processing plant? Tell us about your cheese making experience. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Mark, how would the CURD Act help cheesemakers and processors in Wisconsin? What is the impact to them?
I think it's an educational opportunity to tell people what natural cheese is and distinguish it from a processed cheese. And I think by doing that, people, the misconceptions about what processed cheese and also what maybe natural cheese is.
Do you think the bill would have any effect on consumers? Do we know or care?
That's a good question. For the most part, if you're from Wisconsin, you know the difference. Maybe from another state, the word natural might imply something else. But it's only been around for about 100 years.
You've said there are some misconceptions about processed cheeses. Can you help us understand that? Because as you mentioned there, processed cheese is 95 to 98% cheese.
Right. One of the misconceptions is that only bad cheese goes into making processed cheese. That's not the case. Very tiny amount of cheese that didn't meet certain specifications, it might have an off flavor, it might be too high in moisture, something is wrong with the cheese, or it's too old. We only use about 10% of that in making processed cheese. The rest of the cheese is high-quality cheese made specifically for the processed cheese industry.
Should processed cheese get such a perhaps a bad rap?
No, it's got high nutrition. You know, the only bad rap that I can see, and we're working on this, is it's high in sodium. But we're looking at developing emulsifying salts that don't have sodium in it, so we can use these ingredients that are naturally made from milk that will prevent oiling off and lower the sodium content.
Why do you think we should label it differently then?
Because we add an outside ingredient, the emulsifying salts, to make cheese, to make the processed cheese. The natural cheese, we just take milk, we add rennet, we add coloring that is a naturally based color, and we add salt, and that's it.
You've been in the dairy industry research end of this for decades, more than 30 years. Have you seen technology impact how we make cheese, natural cheese and processed cheese?
Oh, absolutely. It used to be very hands-on. The larger factories were even all hands-on. We've got automated equipment that will do what I used to do with my hands and arms. But we also have ways of concentrating milk before we make cheese. So the typical yield of cheese is about 10 pounds of cheese for 100 pounds of milk. If I remove some of the water before I make the cheese, I can boost that to 13, 14, 15 pounds of cheese for every 100 pounds of milk, which increases the efficiency of dairy plants.
So increased in efficiency, more automation. Have we become better at making cheese through the decades?
Oh, I think so. I judge in cheese contests.
I know.
And I can see the quality of the cheese in those contests have really upscaled. Absolutely.
You've also tasted some cheeses at contests where you worried on the other end of taking that bite about your own health and viability afterward. What was going on there?
Well, I tend to judge the cheeses that are, if you will, weird. They're not the cheddars, the mozzarellas. They're stinky cheeses.
Uh-huh.
Because we've had a lot of experience with them. And in one case at the American Cheese Society, we opened up a package of cheese, and it smelled. It smelled like a barnyard. I mean, in the worst case. You know where I'm going, but I won't say it. And I touched it, and it was fluffy. And so I poked it with a knife, and it went, psst. And I said, I'm not eating that cheese. You know, that was the worst case.
So you didn't touch it. But what makes cheese smelly?
Well, the bacteria have to eat, and there's a lot of bacteria in the cheese, and they're going to basically break down the fats and the proteins, and in the byproduct is going to be the flavor compounds, and some of those are smelly when they get to a high level. Sometimes I add bacteria like the Limburger. I'm adding a yeast also, and a specific type of bacteria that releases sulfur compounds from amino acids that contain sulfur. And they, like hydrogen sulfide, and they stink, sewer gas kind of smell. But the inside of the cheese tastes fine. It's just to get by the nose.
You just have to get past the smell.
Yeah, that's right.
We are learning about the Curd Act and what makes natural cheese natural and what makes processed cheese processed. Mark Johnson is sorting it out for us. He's assistant director at the UW-Madison Center for Dairy Research at UW-Madison. And you can join in. Are you a dairy farmer? Where do you sell your milk? Do you work in a cheese processing plant? Tell us about your cheese making experience at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Tweet us at WPR Mornings. We'll get back to our conversation on cheese processing with Mark Johnson here. Stay with us. News update is next here on the Ideas Network. We're talking about federal legislation. It's called the Curd Act here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Thanks for being here. This bill would create a formal definition of natural cheese, and it's meant to stake some ground, if you will, clear up confusion with melty cheese, processed cheese product that was ladled over your nachos at the concession stand over the weekend. Getting this right is big business. Wisconsin cheesemakers make about a quarter of our country's cheese. Our dairy industry has about a $45 billion economic impact. What questions do you have about how your cheese is made and labeled? Would you support clearer definitions for categories of cheeses? Join in at 800-642-1234. UW-Madison scientist Mark Johnson is assistant director at the Center for Dairy Research, and he stays with us. So, Mark, if the Curd Act passes, and there is bipartisan support for it on Capitol Hill, this would benefit natural cheesemakers. Could it harm in the process processed cheesemakers?
I don't think so. I think people read labels. They can see what's on the processed cheese. I think if people start looking at what natural, then they start thinking about processed cheese and look at it in more detail, they realize that's not such a bad product. It's mostly cheese. It's not bad cheese. It's nutritious. So it's not some chemical concoction that some weird scientist thought up. So it's nutritious food.
Why is processed cheese more affordable than some of the cheeses we see in the cheese section, the natural cheeses?
Well, the processed cheese industry will buy cheese when it's one day old or 2 weeks old, and it's then cheaper because it costs about a penny and a half per pound to age it per month. Plus, they buy cheeses that maybe have gone over the hill on flavor development or the body has broken down too much. These are opportunity cheeses, and you can't sell them at the regular price, so they sell them to the processed cheese industry for a much reduced price, and that lowers the price of then the processed cheese.
What is the makeup of our Wisconsin cheese market? Is it mostly natural or processed cheese? What is the breakdown there?
I don't know what the exact breakdown is, but most of the cheese that we consume is going to be natural cheese. Cheddar and mozzarella, especially pizza cheese.
Pizza, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And that's a natural cheese.
Well, let's take a call now. Dave is joining us from northern Wisconsin. Good morning, Dave.
Hi, good morning.
What's your question?
My question, I have a salt restriction in my diet, and I would appreciate being able to buy a cheese that has a lower salt content. But I never really see that when I go to buy cheese in the supermarket. Is there a way to distinguish, or am I looking in the wrong section of the supermarket to find natural cheese? I never seem to see that.
Yeah, you may not see the word natural cheese on the label, but for salt, you see a sodium. It has to be labeled how much sodium is in the cheese per serving. So you will see that. Processed cheese will have a lot more, but there are some cheeses that are naturally low in sodium, so if you have to restrict your diet and still want cheese, Swiss cheese meets the low sodium requirement. There's ricotta, mascarpone, but typically when I remove the salt out of a cheese that you normally consider salt added, it tastes different. It's very, very, very mild.
Yeah, when
but
I
you
taste
can still
that,
see them.
Taste that lacy Swiss cheese. Mm-hmm. It doesn't taste like some of the other cheeses.
right. So there are some cheeses that are we don't add a lot. We don't add a lot of salt to.
Dave,
it's in a regular cheese section.
You can find it in a regular cheese sections. There are some low sodium products, but because the demand for those is not as high as they used to be, you might find it harder to find.
Dave, what do you think of Swiss cheese?
Oh, I like Swiss cheese, and I realize it is lower in salt content. I purchased some to make some mezcal potatoes with recently. Yeah, it is very good.
Yep.
Well, thanks so much for the call, Dave. Mark, what are some of the most prominent natural cheeses produced in Wisconsin? Where do we make our mark?
We make our mark in cheddar. Cheddar and Italian types, so mozzarella, Parmesan, Romano, those are up and coming. And a lot of Hispanic cheese are being made in Wisconsin. This would be queso fresco, queso blanco cheese.
And what are our most popular exports?
Cheddar and mozz.
Cheddar and mozz.
We also produce majority of what we call specialty cheeses, like Havarti, Munster, Brick, and they're very popular in the state.
How have you seen the scale of operations change over the decades? Do we run a lot of small shops? Are they medium-sized cheese processors?
We have 132 cheese factories in Wisconsin. 41 of those factories make around 90% of the cheese. So we have small manufacturers that maybe process 10 to 20,000 pounds. Those are tiny. And then the medium-sized plants, maybe up to 100,000. And then we have some plants, very few, but we still have plants that process more than 3 million pounds of milk a day. Some out in the West Coast go up to 10 million pounds a day. So most of the factories here, most of the factories would be smaller compared to other states like California and Idaho.
I would assume then Wisconsin milk is being used for this cheese.
Oh, yeah.
Because it's so close. You're so close to the source.
Right. We used to have a deficit, and we'd have to import a lot. But we get import from Minnesota and Iowa. We still do. So... and we used to use a lot of powder from California, so we would say that we would make a lot of good California cheese in Wisconsin.
Have you seen these cheesemakers scale up their operations at all, or do they stay pretty much the same in terms of size?
No, we see them scaling up. We see time and time again what we call small manufacturers adding on, increasing their business. Yep.
We're talking about the CURD Act and the distinction between natural cheese and processed cheese with Mark Johnson. He's a cheese technologist for the Center for Dairy Research at UW-Madison. Your questions are welcome. Do you pay attention to where and how your cheese is made before you buy it? Would you support clear definitions for categories of cheeses? Join in at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Mark, what does it take to become a cheesemaker? What is that process like?
Okay, we have in Wisconsin a requirement to have a cheese made from a licensed cheesemaker. That requires that the apprentice cheesemaker work with a previously licensed cheesemaker for, I think it's over 600 hours. I don't know the exact amount. But you have to have this apprenticeship. You also have to take a test. Most of the test is about the rules, regulations on how to procure milk and how to make the cheese. So it's really for safety purposes. So we make quality cheeses. And then you have to take the test, you know, and pass that test. We have a program sponsored with the Dairy Farmers of Wisconsin called the Master Cheesemaker Program, where we have take licensed cheesemakers. They have to be licensed for at least 10 years, and they get certified in being a master in a certain cheese. They have to have made that cheese for 5 years. They have to take a series of classes at the university. It's a 3-year period of time. They have to take, I think, 5 classes. Their cheeses get judged. Their dairy plant gets judged. And after all of that process, they have to take a test, a written test. It's open book, and it could be 40 to 80 hours to write that test. and they have to verify where they get the answers from.
Wow.
So we give them a series of books and they can read so they become very well educated on how to make cheese.
How long did it take for you to become a judge?
About 20 years. I had very good mentors, and I think they were like training me, but didn't quite feel like I was there until one day one of the head judge of a contest who I knew said, I have this contest I want you to judge. So he kind of put me in a trial and error, I think, see if I could do it. And so I guess I succeeded because I've been doing it for the last 20 years.
Well, let's take a call here. Saul is joining us from Stevens Point. Hi, Saul.
Yeah, hi. I had two questions. The first one was, shredded cheese is really popular now, and what do they use to keep the shreds from sticking together? Because when I do it myself, it's all lumps up.
Oh, absolutely. They're going to add something like, it's called an anti-caking agent, which is cellulose or starch, and they add it up to just the amount that's necessary to keep the curds or the strands from re-knitting together again. And that's roughly around 2% of the weight of the cheese is this cellulose or starch they add.
Does that... go ahead, Saul.
Is it something I'd taste?
No.
Or sense in some
way? You could sense if they use too much. There's no standard on how much they... how much they can add. It's just pretty much don't add more than you need. But some people, and sometimes in some cases, they might add a little bit too much, and you might get a grittiness in your mouth, like a chalky feeling. You can actually see it, a little white specks on the surface of the shreds.
I was going to say, does it give you any discoloration?
It might get a little white,
mm-hmm.
So it doesn't look shiny. It's you can see there might be like crystals on it or something. That's when they overdo it. I might add, though, that if you bake with that, the anti-caking agents will prevent the cheese from melting as well. They'll stick together a little, or not stick together, won't flow as readily as you do if you shredded it at home and used it right away. But it's still good. You're not going to taste it.
All right. Well, Saul, thanks so much for the call. And Mark, thank you so much for coming by. We appreciate it.
All right. Thank you for having me.
Mark Johnson is Assistant Director at the UW-Madison Center for Dairy Research, and he joined us to talk about the Curd Act and what makes cheese natural or processed. Coming up, we take stock of the Packers halfway through the regular season. How are you feeling? Did you watch last night's victory over the Chiefs? What were the highs and lows for you? We're at 800-642-1234. Back in a moment for some Packers conversation. Stay with us here on the Ideas Network. Happy Monday. We're talking Packers for a spell here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. New coach, new players, new philosophies. The Packers appear to be hitting their stride with a 7-1 record leading the NFC North. We're checking in mid-season as they beat the Kansas City Chiefs at Kansas City last night. Are you a Packers fan? Did you watch last night's game against the Chiefs? What do you think worked well for the Pack last night? We're at 800-642-1234. Caitlin Sharkey is a sports anchor and reporter for WITI Fox 6 News in Milwaukee. Caitlin, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Happy to be here. Thank you for having me.
So 31-24, huh?
Yeah, it was an exciting game. We didn't expect a shootout, I don't think, with the Chiefs backup quarterback, but that's what we got, and it was a good game for sure.
What did you learn about the Packers last night?
To me, what stuck out was the fact that they were leading. They lost. They allowed 17 unanswered points. You know, they kind of lost their momentum. And the way they responded, I think over the last couple seasons, the Packers had trouble doing that. You know, if they got down in the game, they wouldn't be able to respond. The defense was having issues. They wouldn't find a way to kind of come back. And that's exactly what they did. They rallied. head coach Matt LaFleur called a heck of a game. Andy Reid's an outstanding coach, and it was kind of fun to watch those two kind of play this chess match of offenses going back and forth. But the way they responded, the way they used the offense, the way Aaron Jones and Aaron Rodgers kind of connected on a number of plays, it was exciting to watch for sure.
Where did you see them struggle or seem to struggle on the field?
To me, it was defensively. Their defense started so strong this season. It seemed to feel like they were in all the right places. They were ball hawks. They were tackling well. Last night, you saw a little of that kind of go away. They weren't tackling as well. But that's also a matter of Andy Reid and the Chiefs' offense, just the way they kind of figured out Mike Pettine's system for a while. Mm-hmm. But they got the takeaways that they needed. But defensively, yes, they needed to clean it up. There's a number of things I'm sure they'll look back on the tape and see that they can't have happen moving forward.
So Aaron Rodgers threw 3 touchdowns, more than 300 yards. How did he perform?
He's obviously an elite quarterback, but there's some of those games where you look at him and you're like, wow, that was really outstanding. He had a touchdown pass to Jamal Williams in the back of the end zone when it looked like he was going to throw the ball away, and he's falling down and he's kind of side-arming it. And it was just one of those vintage Aaron Rodgers moments where you're watching and you're like, how did he do that?
But vintage, I love it.
Yes, it's like, you know, you watch these plays and you're like, did he just do that? And head coach Matt LaFleur said after the game that was the best throw he's ever seen live in person. And I think it's just a matter of Rodgers. Obviously, we all know he's an elite quarterback, but kind of finding his rhythm now in Matt LaFleur's offense. Week after week, they kind of get better because they're getting more comfortable. They're using more weapons. With the talent that he has, it's a positive connection for sure.
We're talking with Caitlin Sharkey. She's a sports anchor and reporter for WITI in Milwaukee. We've been taking stock of the Packers midway through the season. You can join in. What did you think went well for the Packers last night? Where do you see the team under pressure? Why did they win? Join in at 800-642-1234. Caitlin, the Packers have seen a bunch of injuries, though, to their wide receivers this year, leaving some sidelined or with less game time. How have you seen the Packers adjust?
I think that's been the most interesting part of it all, because Devontae Adams, their top receiver and one of the top receivers in the league, has now missed half of their games, which you think that would be such a devastating blow, and it is for sure, no doubt. But the fact that they've adapted and used their running backs in Aaron Jones and Jamal Williams to kind of fill that gap and that void and get creative has been really, like, it's been super productive for them, but also really fun to watch because those two are very dynamic. So just kind of watching Aaron Jones had 159 receiving yards last night for a running back and a number of touchdowns. And they went to him on the final play to kind of seal the victory. And I think that shows a lot of confidence in Matt LaFleur and just creativity on how they can use their players to kind of fill that void. Obviously, you always want Devontae Adams on the field anytime you can have him. But I think a number of others, Jake Kumerow, the Whitewater grad, he also has kind of stepped into this role. So they have a number of weapons, and it's worked well for them. But I'm sure they're ready for Devontae to come back.
So here we are midseason, Packers sitting at the top of their division in a really good spot to compete for playoffs. Is the team considered a real contender for the Super Bowl? What do you think?
I think it's tough to tell at this point. I think they couldn't be more happy with the start they've had. I think there was a lot of unknowns coming into this season, and the fact that they kind of have solidify their spot in the division. Their schedule here on out it doesn't look that tough, right? So they're going to go to LA. They shouldn't have any problem with the Chargers. Packer fans travel well to LA, so that should feel like a home game. So I really think there's no signs of slowing down with this team. Of course, it's a long season, so it's hard to make those Super Bowl predictions because anything could happen from here to now. But I think if they continue to play the way they have been playing, I think it's only going to get better. I think defensively they need to clean a lot of things up, and their defense needs to be better if they want to be in serious Super Bowl talk.
Okay, so what teams could spell trouble for their playoff hopes?
Oh, man. I don't think there's any major. 49ers could be the big one. I think that's the one I look on my calendar and I go, okay, that's going to be a tough test because they've kind of established their spot in the division. The Chargers are having a down season. There's other teams that are the Panthers, you know, that they shouldn't be a challenge for them looking ahead. But 49ers are off to a hot start. that'll be an interesting game, and that could be a huge NFC matchup with playoff implications moving forward.
So Matt LaFleur must be feeling pretty good, though. What have you learned about his coaching style after watching him this first year?
I think to me it's that he had a plan coming in. He had a mindset. He had this idea of what he could do, what he wanted to do, how he wanted to do it, and he stuck to it. I think there's obviously learning curves, and there's, you know, there's going to be a little bump starting out in the season, but the way that he kind of brought his own flavor, he brought this new energy to the Packers, and I think that's something that they needed. They seem to be having more fun. They're more relaxed. Maybe it's because of his age. I don't know. It's one of those things where he just brings this, like, youthful energy to the team, and I think they needed that, and it's fun to watch. They're all smiley. It's fun to watch their dynamic between Aaron and Matt, like just how close they seem to be, and they can razz each other a little bit. You can see on the sideline if things aren't going perfectly, but it's two competitive spirits going at it, and it's fun to watch.
So fans thought he would bring a different style for offensive strategy to the team. Has he done that?
I think so. I think the way that he's used the Packers haven't had a solid run game in a few seasons, a couple seasons now, if you could think about it. But the fact that he can use different weapons, I think in the last couple seasons, Aaron Rodgers, it's fallen heavily on him and his arm and what he's able to do. And rightfully so, he's a MVP quarterback. But I don't think there was that much creativity in thinking about how he could use tight ends and running backs and receivers all as weapons for Rodgers. And I think LaFleur has done a great job of different play calls and just trying to figure out the best way to maximize Aaron's talents and also the talents that he has in the running back. I mean, those running backs are fourth and fifth round picks. You would never think they'd evolve to be such game changers, but he's kind of figured out a way to use them to their best capabilities.
All right, so look back on your calendar here. What are some big games coming up on the Packers schedule?
Oh, like I said, the 49ers for sure. I'm interested to see that one. Anytime they play in the division is always kind of interesting, because anytime they play their division opponents again, it's always fun to figure out how it's going to shake out. And it's this season, you look at their schedule, a lot of people are like, oh, they could finish 14-2. That's a realistic finish for them, because if things stay the way they do. But for me, it's the 49ers game for sure. The Chargers game, it'll be fun for them to see how much Packer fans travel. They shouldn't have any problem in L.A., but they started the season at home a lot, and that was a big part of taking advantage of those games at home. They played 5 of 6 at Lambeau, so anytime they play in Green Bay, obviously, is an advantage. So it should be smooth sailing, you would think, here on out. So look out for that.
Well, Caitlin, thank you so much for joining us.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me.
Caitlin Sharkey is a sports anchor and reporter for WITI Fox 6 News in Milwaukee. This is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to the Ideas Network.